From San Francisco to Paris, Nashville to Amsterdam, we're reaching up.
This is John Fass in San Francisco, and we're reaching up again this week with music, some cool wisdom, and special guests.
Hello, friend. This is Pat Boone with Don Fass on Reaching Up.
On a day like today, we pass the time away, writing love letters in the sand. How you laughed when I cried each time I saw the tide take our love letters on the sand. You made a vow that you would ever be true, but somehow that vow heartaches with every wave that breaks over love letters in the sand.
This is Don Fass, and as some of you know, we've just gotten back from an event called Spirit West Coast, where we spent time with Matthew West and the Barlow Girls and Phil Joel and Michael Tate of the Newsboys, and saw some incredible concerts. And what a way to end this holiday weekend with sitting in the home of someone I grew up listening to. I've got to tell you that, Pat. We're here with Pat Boone in Beverly Hills, and what a delight.
Ah, thank you, Don. I wish I could have been with you at that Spirit event, because I've been involved along with my pop music, and boy, thank God I've been very successful in pop music, rock, country, you know, movie stuff. But I'm in the Gospel Music Hall of Fame, and I've been at a number of those big music festivals, and I love them. The thing I love most, of course, I love the music and the performers, but to see young people in this day and age that are so turned on and as excited about spiritual things as they are about sports, as they are about music idols, as they are about anything, they're willing to come unglued and go 100%, you know, for things that they truly believe in and that are worthwhile. So I wish I could have been with you.
Since you mentioned that, I just want to say that several months ago I interviewed a crossover rock group that are very big, Skillet. And John from Skillet was saying that what he'd like to see was young people really more enthusiastic about almost anything, including God, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, but
yeah, because young people are, of course, innately enthusiastic, and they want to be enthusiastic about something. But I had a funny conversation once with Jackie Mason, the comedian, the Jewish comedian, and he was saying, "Bet, what are we going to do? What are we going to do about these kids that are into this rap and this crap and all of this stuff?" And he says, it's ruining their lives. What are we going to do? And I said, "Look, I've got the answer, Jackie, if you really want to know." "You do?" And I said, "Yes." I said, "What you have to do is get a congressman to introduce a bill, get it through one house, in the House of Representatives or the Senate, making it a misdemeanor for anybody under 18 to be in possession of classical music."
Ah, okay.
And I said, if that becomes a misdemeanor, if it becomes illegal, they'll be sneaking classical music to school, saying, hey, at recess, I got some Shostakovich for you. Hey, I got some great Beethoven, man. You're going to love it. Oh, here comes the teacher. He said, Jackie said, "That's brilliant. That's brilliant. I wish I'd thought of it. In fact, I will think of it." But yeah, kids today, they want to be enthused about something that's of value, and they're willing to commit to it, you know, as you saw in the election of Barack Obama. It was several million young people who had not been interested enough to vote, They got all exercised, and they helped carry him over the top. So I love to see kids really enthused about something that is truly worth their excitement.
Now, when I was growing up, which was essentially in the 50s and the early 60s, we had a musical backdrop to our lives. I mean, sure, kids do today, too. But not the same. I mean, not really. And in terms of pop music, and if I can use an old-fashioned term that probably some members of my audience have never heard, swooning and romantic music and all that, in addition to the rock side of pop, you were one of the people that we listened to and we danced to. How did your musical career come about, and how did you become a pop star?
Well, it was miraculous, but 'cause I sang in Nashville, Tennessee, where I grew up. I loved all the current pop tunes, and I was a fan of Perry Como, Bing Crosby, Nat King Cole, Eddie Fisher, and even Vic Damone, Patti Page, who was a little ahead of me. And I was constantly being asked to sing for all kinds of functions, and even on local television, for nothing. You know, I never got paid anything. I just did it for the fun of it, and because I truly sort of had this fantasy idea about becoming a pop singer, although I knew it was impossible. Still, I won a Nashville contest, which sent me to a local talent contest. The first prize, a trip to New York to appear on the Ted Mack Amateur Hour. Now, that was the forerunner of American Idol. It was very big. It was on television Saturday nights, and the viewers in cards and letters determined the winner each week by the volume of votes. And so I won three times in a row. As a kid from Nashville singing pop tunes, that led to a recording contract, the very first record. Age 20, I transferred to North Texas State in Denton, Texas, married at 19, now my first record at 20, and it was a huge hit of a what we call rock and roll. It was really rhythm and blues, but it's "One Heart's Not Enough, Baby." One, two hearts will make you feel crazy. One kiss will make you feel so nice. Two kisses take you to paradise. Two hearts, two kisses make one love. Well, that became a big rock and roll hit. The next one was "Ain't That a Shame," Fats Domino's song, big rhythm and blues hit. I did the rock and roll pop version. After that, it was nonstop. For about 5 years, I was never off the charts.
Ain't that a shame? My tears fell like rain. Ain't that a shame? You're the one to blame. You broke my heart when you said we'll part. Ain't that a shame? My tears fell like rain. Ain't that a shame? You're the one to blame. Farewell, goodbye, although I'll cry. Ain't that a shame? Tears fell like rain. Ain't that a shame? You're the one to blame.
One of the distinctions I hold in the record business is 220 weeks on the single record charts without ever being off. Nobody's ever done that. Elvis, the Beatles, Elton John. Elton came closer, really. He was on like 159 weeks. But then he missed a week, and you have to go back and start over. So for 220 weeks, I always had at least one, sometimes two hits on the charts at the same time. And I got used to living there. I was stunned the first time that I looked at a billboard or a cash box or a Record World magazine, and I wasn't there anywhere. Hey, wait a minute. This is my business now. This is who I am. But I had to get used to the idea that I'd been given all these hit records just miraculously, and that it was no guarantee that it would just keep going forever. And it didn't, of course. I did get back on the charts a number of times with big hit records, but it was just miraculous.
We're gonna let our audience hear some of those songs at this point before we come back to talk to you. But I just want to tell people that, of course, back then, no such thing as iTunes and iPods. We used to run to the local Woolworths 5 and 10, mm-hmm. and they would have racked up the top 30 or 40 singles of the moment.
45s or 33 and a third.
Yeah, absolutely.
Same as an album, but it was just one song on each side.
And then I also remember, I don't know what year it was, the excitement when there was the first stereo single.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even remember who did it.
But no, I don't either, even though I was right there in the middle of it. But then it went from 33 and a third singles to 45s RPM, and then, of course, to eventually to 8 tracks and cassettes and music discs and CDs. And now, of course, with the Internet, you know, you can just go and download one song again if you want, just the single, if that's all you want. You can have just that for about 99 cents, I think, is about the average.
I don't remember what we paid for singles in the late 50s or early 60s, but I have a feeling it was probably somewhere like 25 to 50 cents.
My recollection is, yours may be better, but I'm thinking for a 45 single, of course it had a song on the other side, or even a 33 and a third, that it was probably at $1, $1.10 or something like that. Maybe I'm wrong. But so now we may be back to about where we were 50 years ago.
And also some artists are putting out vinyl again.
Yeah, because they think, and maybe some audiophiles can validate it, that that vinyl has a richness and a depth that digital doesn't. I don't know. I really can't tell the difference.
You better come home, Speedy Gonzales, away from Tannery Row. Stop all of your drinking with that poochie name Flo. Come on home to your adobe and slap some mud on the wall. The roof is leaking like a strainer. There's loads of roaches in the hall. Speedy Gonzales, why don't you come home? Speedy Gonzales, how come you leave me all alone?
Hey, Rosita, I have to go shopping downtown for my mother. She needs some tortillas and chili peppers.
Your dog is gonna have a puppy, and we're running out of coke. No enchiladas in the icebox, and the television's broke. I saw some lipstick on your sweatshirt, I smell some perfume in your ear. Well, if you're gonna keep on messing, don't bring your business back out here. Speedy Gonzales, why don't you come home? Speedy Gonzales, how come you leave me all alone?
Hey, Rosita, come quick. Down in the cantina, they're giving green stamps with tequila.
And what about our American kids? How will they get hers and his?
American kids, youth violence, STDs, hunger, runaways, bullying, poverty, low self-esteem. Find out how you can help. Click Do Good on CelebrateRadio.com or OneHeartForKids.com. This message from Street Cats Foundation, One Heart for Kids, and this station.
American kids.
Shine your light, shine your light.
New music, new hope. Our new CD with King Crimson's Adrian Belew, Peter Paul and Mary's Peter Yarrow, Zender, Tom Paxton, Brian Duncan, Pam Thumb, The Bittersweets, Craig Taubman, Debbie Friedman, and many more. Incredible music benefiting children in need all over the world. A great gift for yourself or others at cdbaby.com, oneheartforkids.com. New music, new hope. The exciting, uplifting album that helps people all over the world. Get it, play it, enjoy it, give it, and help kids all over the world. New music, new hope. Also at reachingupradio.com. Reachingupradio.com.
So you were on the charts continuously for a long while. What was it like the first time you heard one of your songs on the radio?
Oh, man, it was it was such a heady experience. It does something to you inside. It can be like a drug because you can get so addicted to it that you just crave it afterwards. And that happens to a lot of performers. It's sort of sad. That's why I always tell young people when they ask me about how they can get into the record business, try, first of all, prepare for something else that you know you can do. I was going to be a school teacher. That's what I was diligently preparing to be, was a school teacher. But I was singing and even recording on the side, and the records became hits. But even after they became big hits, and I had my own television show and made movies, I still insisted on finishing college at Columbia University and really thought that I was going to apply for an English teacher's job in a high school somewhere. But then I realized, wait a minute, I've got this recording contract, the movie contract, the TV contract. I guess I'm going to have to fulfill these before I start to take a teaching assignment somewhere. Of course, that never happened. But the point is that it is a fickle, fickle business. And
even more so now, I think.
Oh, yeah. It can be so unfair. I mean, look at American Idol, somebody that was huge for weeks and weeks, and girls screaming. You don't ever hear of him anymore. He's gone. I mean, it was a flash in the pan kind of thing. They're talented, but they just didn't get the breaks. And for me, Randy Wood of Dot Records was picking the songs, most of them along the way, and he just had a radar sense about what the public would go for and what I could sing that would please them. And of course, I was always adaptable. I was willing to sing anything if it was moral, at least. I turned down some songs because I thought they were pretty racy and I didn't do them. But there was always enough music that I could just keep them coming.
Did Dot ever... Record companies used to pick the A side of a single and the B side. Did you ever have a B side become a hit?
Oh, the biggest record I've ever had was Love Letters in the Sand. And it was the B side of Bernadine, which was a million selling single. If we'd known they were both going to be million sellers, we would not have put them on the same record. But Bernadine was the title tune to my first movie. Johnny Mercer wrote this cute song. It wasn't really rock and roll, but it had a beat, and because I was hot at the time, it went on to become a number one million selling hit. But the other side was Love Letters in the Sand, just a song that Bing Crosby had introduced 30 years before, and Randy Wood at Dot felt like it had hit potential, and so we recorded it, put it in the movie Bernadine. Didn't have anything to do with the story, but I just threw it in. And then we put it on as a B-side on Bernadine. And when Bernadine had reached its peak, number one, and was beginning to fade, the DJ said, well, let's hear the other side of this record. And they turned it over, and the phones lit up, and Love Letters in the Sand became a bigger hit than Bernadine. And it was just the B-side.
We used to do that on the radio all the time, by the way. Often play B-sides. It wasn't restrictive like it is now, where there's practically an accountant watching over what you play.
Yeah, formats and all that. You know, it was so much fun when, for instance, and this is when the record business was absolutely exciting fun. I went to the studio one afternoon here in Los Angeles to record a song, a country hit by a guy named Chase Webster. The song was called Moody River. And it was a sad song about a girl that jumped in the river because she couldn't face her lover, her boyfriend, and tell him that she'd been unfaithful to him. And so she left a note and her glove and jumped in the Moody River, more deadly than the Venus knife. Moody River, your muddy water took my baby's life. Well, I recorded that in the afternoon, and we put it in a high key so I would sound pained, and I was. Now I go from the studio to pick up my wife at a friend's house. And we're there an hour and a half, and we're getting ready to leave to come home for dinner. And the radio was on to a top 40 station here in L.A. And I hear ba-da-ba-da-ba-ba-da-ba-ba-da-ba-ba-ba, the intro to the song I've been just singing. And we turned up the volume just quick enough to hear the DJ at that moment say, "Now, ladies and gentlemen, for the first time anywhere, our new pick hit of the week, Pat Boone's Moody River."
Moody River, more deadly than the vainest knife. Moody River, your mighty water took my baby's life. Last Saturday evening came to the old oak tree. It stands beside the river where you were to meet me. On the ground your glove I found with a note addressed to me. It read, "Dear love, I've done you wrong. Now I must set you free. No longer can I live with this hurt and this sin. I just couldn't tell you that guy was just a friend. Moody River, more deadly than the vainest knife. Moody River, your muddy water took my baby's life."
I wasn't home from the studio from recording the song, and it was the pick hit of the week on a major top 40 station because Randy Wood took a what we call a hot disc, that is, he made just a dub of the record we just made, ran it over to the program director at the big station, said, "What do you think?" And he said, "It's great. Going to be a hit. Can we have an exclusive for a week?" "Yep, you got it. Pick hit of the week, and I'm not home from recording the song." Well, that's when the DJs and radio had the freedom to play whatever they wanted to play. It wasn't all dictated by some polls, by some research group, by some executive board at a record company or whatever. They just played whatever they liked.
The time period that we're talking about, Bernadette and Moody River and all the rest, date that for us.
Well, 55 was my first record. Here's a stat that for Trivial Pursuit people, because nobody ever did this but Pat Boone, and I say it was miraculous. I'm not taking credit. I didn't pick the songs. I just sang them. But March of 55 was my first record. That was Two Hearts, Two Kisses. August of that same year, I had the next record, and that was putting out a record quickly. But Ain't That a Shame went right to number one in about 2 weeks. October of that year, and they were both million sellers. The October, a song called At My Front Door. Crazy little mama come knocking, knocking at my front door, door, door. And may not sound like a hit to kids today, but it was a big hit then with a good solid rock beat. And that went to the top 10 in October. Then in December, the fourth record, a song called G. Whitaker's, which is not a great song, but on the momentum of the other three, it too became a million seller. Then in February, 1st of February of 56, a two-sided hit, a Tutti Frutti, Little Richard song, and I'll Be Home, the Flamingos R&B song. Both were hits. Both were million-selling singles. Now that tells you, and this was about, just a few weeks before Elvis' first record of Heartbreak Hotel. So in that 11-month period from March of 55 to February of 56, I had 6 million-selling singles, 2 of them number ones, I'll Be Home and Ain't That a Shame. 2 number ones and 6 million sellers in 11 months. So thank God it happened that way, because when Elvis hit the scene with Heartbreak Hotel, then Hound Dog, Don't Be Cruel, all those songs, he swept a lot of other singers away, but I just stayed right in there and matched him hit for about 5 years.
And then the Beatles were coming.
Oh, then the Beatles knocked us all out of the box, and six out of the top 10 at one time. But I weathered that storm too.
I got a bad reputation.
Know why?
I brush my hair.
brush my teeth, I go to church. I'm a really nice guy.
You had a controversial period, not going all the way back to the 50s, where you were wearing leather and a kind of a motorcycle guy and all that. Tell us about that and what the point of it was.
Well, it was. it started out as a joke. I was on the road, and there was humor in it, and I'm proud of what actually did happen. But I was on the road with my musicians. We were in England, and one of them, between planes, said, "Hey, Pat, we like doing, you know, your music. They're younger than I am. The hit records, the people that pay, they love it. But why don't we do something new? We can go in a studio and record something new." I said, "Guys, what can I do? I haven't done 100 times, or 10 times anyway. Done pop and gospel and rock and roll, rhythm and blues, movie themes, even a couple of talk records. But they said, "Well, you never did any heavy metal." Well, that was a joke. We laughed about it for weeks. When are we going to do our heavy metal album? One day, my conductor, Dave Siebel, said, "You know, we've been laughing about this, but there are good songs that only metalheads know. And if we did some of those good songs and did them a different way, you know, they might be hits again, and to people that don't know anything about them right now." I said, "What do you mean, what other way would we?" He said, "Well, maybe big band jazz." Well, I love that notion, because I love big band swing, even rocking big band. And I said, "What? Tell me about these good songs, because I don't know any good metal, heavy metal song." So they made me some cassettes, my musicians did, of songs by Van Halen, by Ozzy Osbourne, by Metallica, by Alice Cooper, and AC/DC, and, you know, all of these groups, even Judas Priest. I never liked their name, but I recorded one of their songs, "You Got Another Thing Coming." And sure enough, when I listened to the songs, apart from the loud clanging music, I discovered there were some lyrics that were good, the good melodies. So what we did, we started out and we made an album of heavy metal classics with big band jazz arrangements.
I got no friends 'cause they read the papers. You know they can't be seen with me. And I'm getting real shot down and I'm feeling me. Mr. Nice Guy, no more. Mr. Hey, no more. Mr. Nice Guy, they say he's sick, he's obscene. My dog bit me on the leg today. My cat clawed my eye. My mom's been thrown out of the society circle. My dad has to hide. Recognized me and punched me in the nose. He said, "No more, Mr. Nice Guy. No more, Mr. Clean. No more, Mr. Nice Guy."
Next week, Pat tells Don more about his heavy metal adventure, how he came to write the lyrics to Exodus, his gospel music, and his faith. Pat Boone back with Don next week. Don't miss it.
This is Don Fass. Join us next weekend and keep reaching up.
Write Don at celebrateradio@gmail.com or on the UCR website and tell us what you think.
This is the Celebrate Radio Network.
Radio Network.
From Seattle to Paris, Bangkok to Jerusalem.